Ожесточенные бои идут в районе Луганска и Донецка.
Последняя информация о боевых действиях на юго-востоке Украины. Силовики этой ночью...
Ну, под огнем артиллерии и Луганск.
Его что, обстрелило... визит Ангела Меркель в Киев намечен на эти выходные?
Зачем
но
едет нам Меркель?
Владимир зачем? Путин вместе с лидерами стран таможенного союза
встретится с Петром Порошенко. Состоится и ряд двусторонних.
26 августа в Минске лидер Украинские
Forces drive deep into pro-Moscow separatist strongholds of Donetsk and Luhansk. German Chancellor Angela Merkel prepares to visit Kyiv over the weekend with talks of a peace deal in the air. And a meeting is scheduled between Kremlin leader Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko in Minsk next week. Since the annexation of Crimea in March and throughout the conflict in the Donbass region, much of the Russian elite and public have been living in something of a collective hallucination. Fantasies about imperial glory and Novorossiya were in the air. St. George ribbons were ubiquitous, and Putin's popularity surged past 80%. It was a dizzying mirage that reset Russia's domestic politics. But eventually, reality intrudes on every hallucination, and that reality is often accompanied by a nasty hangover. So if the Ukraine crisis is really winding down, if the hallucination is really over, what will the new normal look like? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London for an encore following last week's debut is Peter Pomerantsev, author of the forthcoming book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, The Serial Heart of the New Russia. Welcome back, Peter.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming back. And also joining us from London and also via Skype is another astute Kremlin watcher. Ben Judah is a journalist and author of the book Fragile Empire, How Russians Fell Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Welcome back, Ben.
Thank you.
Peter, let's get the ball rolling with you. It was because it was some of your comments on last week's podcast that got me thinking about this week's theme. What Russia's new normal can look like in the aftermath of this crisis. You argued rather convincingly that the Putin system's based on passive acceptance, or as you memorably put it, on the ethos of I steal, you steal, we all steal together. You also made the point that given that system, an 80% plus approval rating for Putin based on constant agitation and mobilization was too hot and that it needed to be cooled down a bit. And I also think that's right. And this is the model that worked in Putin's first two terms in the Kremlin, right? But in the third term, when his ratings dropped perilously into the 40s, when the regime was genuinely appeared unpopular, well, if the 80%, you know, very popular Putin right now is too hot, that was a little too cold. And we've been in this kind of permanent mobilization since Putin came back, as you pointed out last week. It was just dialed up to 11 with the Ukraine crisis. In past podcasts, we've compared this to a hit of cocaine that eventually wears off and creates a need for another hit of cocaine, this permanent mobilization model. It's inherently, just as cocaine is unhealthy for the human organism, this permanent mobilization is inherently unhealthy for the body politic, so to speak. So, Peter, my question's this. Can Putin reset things back to the old equilibrium? That 60% sweet spot that you talked about, and the rating is just a barometer for how the system is operating, or are we in a situation where the regime's popularity and thus legitimacy will be dangerously low unless he keeps giving Russians their cocaine, so to speak, metaphorically speaking, of course? Has this regime become addicted to permanent agitation and mobilization?
So listen, it's not just based on happy stuff. There's something else that the Putin regime and the sort of the reboot of the Putin regime is based on. It's not just the Kool-Aid they've been putting in the water. They've also been reintroducing fear. What we saw in Bolotna was not just, as Ben beautifully puts it, Russia falling out of love with Vladimir Putin. It was Russia falling out of fear with Vladimir Putin. And the Ukraine crisis aside, the perpetual mobilization, which started in 2011, 2012, with the search for inner enemies and, you know, American plot that started Bolotna. At the same time, there was also the reintroduction of fear with the Bolotna arrest, with this crazy new legislation, which basically means that if you, you know, swear, you can get arrested. So what will, you know, even if the good, happy sort of drug starts to wear off, the fear drugs, which are pushing this rating as much as the love, will keep on going, and I expect will intensify. So we'll see more arrests, more purges. It's the old, you know, it's an old Soviet kind of habit. Nowadays, you don't have to do that many arrests to spread fear. So they'll be pumping up the fear factor.
Do you think the fear works without the, let's use Kool-Aid for the metaphor? Does the fear work without the Kool-Aid?
Like every sect, I mean, I find actually sects are quite useful to examine Russia. You know, all sects work with that. They scare their kind of, you know, Scientologists or whatever. They scare the people inside of it. They'll crush them or reject them. And then they give them highs as well. So they'll keep on giving the highs. I completely agree. Now they've started the perpetual mobilization. They'll keep on having to invent new conflicts. I think they might go for the Arctic. You know, I'm just betting here. That'll be a great one. That's the ideal war for Putin. No one dies, lots of snow, but there's a real tussle for the Arctic that can happen.
And it's really consequential.
And it's what?
It's also consequential. There's serious resources up there.
Real thing. Like the Danes want that kind of bit of ice and all the hydrocarbons.
So do the Canadians. So do the Americans.
Exactly. That's what I mean. There's a real conflict. But the problem with the Ukraine one was Crimea was great. In Ukraine, you have real kind of semi-Russians dying. And that's actually not a very good... I don't think Putin wants body bags. That's not what he wants. Mm. He wants sort of like, you know, faux wars, movies about wars. So I think, yes, you're quite right. Perpetual mobilization will continue. But fear. Fear is going to be the main one. So it'll be search for enemies in the midst, fifth columnists, traitors under the bed, purges, all that good old Stalinist stuff.
So when the Ukraine crisis wears down, there's going to be another brand of Kool-Aid out there for them.
Well, the Ukraine crisis, they can keep that going because they clearly want to freeze the conflict. And people talk about North Ossetia. I think he'll actually look for an East Berlin moment out of it. So we'll have our bit of Ukraine and their bit of Ukraine. So they can keep that narrative going. But yeah, you'll probably need a few more kind of like, invented conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Ben, what do you think? Is this regime addicted to mobilization and agitation, or can it reset it back to the passive acceptance model that Peter talked about last week, the old I steal, you steal, we all steal together model?
I think it's very important when thinking about what's going to happen next to remember what did happen, which is this is not the first time Putin's fought a war, and this is not the first time that Putin's going to go into a recession. And if we go back to 2008, during the Georgian War, you saw Putin's popularity achieve roughly the same level of around 80 to 85%. That seems to be the top limit of what it can go. And it's not very exceptional for leaders to get about an 80 to 85% approval rating during wars. That's the approval rating that George Bush got after 9/11. That's the approval rating that
his father got during the first Gulf War.
Exactly. That's the approval rating that Benjamin Netanyahu recently experienced at the start of the ongoing Gaza conflict between Israel and Hamas. And that's, of course, what Putin had in 2008. So what happened to that really high approval rating? That approval rating basically went down slowly, not in a sudden collapse, as Russian real incomes collapsed during the 2009 recession. Russia went through a very steep recession. It was the steepest recession in the G20. And as that started to hit, and as real incomes stopped growing and started to decline, you saw a decline in Putin's popularity, bottoming out at around 50 to 40% in 2012. So that's what's probably going to happen next, unless they can come up or implement with any of the techniques that Peter's just described to distract people from that. The consequences of the finally relatively tough European sanctions are likely to be a recession. There's going to be a credit crunch on Russian state banks. That's going to lead to serious pinch in Russian state corporations, which are dependent on state banks. And that may lead to freezes in workers' salaries. That may lead to layoffs. That may lead to retrenchment. That's certainly going to lead to wages not rising in line with inflation, because that's the next big problem they're going to face, which they didn't really face in the last major recession Russia had. Like, inflation is one of the big killers we can observe in political science for popularity. And already, as a result of Putin's food ban, we are seeing Very high inflation figures coming out of the St. Petersburg regional government. The St. Petersburg regional government has been reporting double-digit inflation on meat and cheese and poultry. And this is most likely because lots of businessmen are using their ties to the Russian authorities to establish quick monopolies over food products which are temporarily or perhaps permanently banned from being imported overseas. Can you really distract the Russian population from double-digit inflation and recession using permanent mobilization? I think up to a point. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth remembering that the Soviet Union was a permanent mobilization model, and the Soviet Union rolled on perpetual campaigns, and that when these issues of shortages and inflation really started to hit, Russians very quickly tired of that permanent mobilization model. It would be interesting. I don't know whether this will happen, but it would be interesting to see whether or not in the years to come, the same mental strategies towards dealing with one campaign after another, first the kind of fifth column under the bed, then the Banderovtsi, now the enemies for our Arctic, whether those same withdrawing, not listening, mental patterns in Russia will reappear.
Yeah, no, Peter, I think Ben raises an interesting point here. The Kool-Aid works great in good economic times. But when you have real economic deprivation, which it looks like Russia might be headed toward, especially if these sanctions remain in place, and you know this so-called aid convoy crossed in today, it's unclear what the hell it's doing, and where it's going to go. My suspicion is they're going to use it there to freeze the conflict, to basically set it up so Ukraine can't advance any more on rebel positions. And as the Georgians know, once the so-called Russian peacekeepers were in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, they never left. Well, once these aid workers are never going to leave either. So if these sanctions, and then that would follow, I would expect the sanctions to remain in place, if not get tougher. Russia could be headed for serious economic deprivation here. Can you do the fear and cocaine tandem, you know, in these conditions? Is Ben right? Can you only distract the population to a point? Is this going to start to ring hollow, even for a Kremlin that's so good at putting on a show?
Yeah, that's why I think the show is not enough. I mean, the fear is very real. I mean, even if you're sick of the Kool-Aid, the fear will keep it going. So that's so I think we'll see a lot more fear. That's just the logical. That's what they're just going to have to do to scare people and intimidate them. So yes. I mean, I think there's something else going on, which is kind of more systemic. Well, not more systemic, more sort of psychological. I mean, one way of looking at this kind of what's going on in Russia, because there was no need for this crisis. There was no need for this conflict. This was completely invented for utterly perverse political technological reasons. There was no rational need for any of this. Russia could have kept on doing perpetual mobilization at home while making great money abroad. You know, it was a great system. It was corrupting the West. It was trundling along. There's actually no need for this. It's been sort of several moments of madness. And I think that's very interesting because, you know, when I look at that generation, the Putin generation, and the kind of the sort of the psychology that they have, which is basically kind of an institutionalized, I use the term very casually, sort of like schizophrenia and madness. They're genuinely paranoid. They genuinely do see sort of plots everywhere. They have this, you know, bizarre idea that you have to sort of always shapeshift and change your personality to different situations. They're obsessed with deception. It's a whole kind of fairly, you know, bizarre and sociopathic mentality. And sort of the tension in Russia is becoming between sanity and more of this kind of madness.
You speak of the Putin generation being the people of Putin's generation is what I'm assuming, right? Not the generation that came up under Putin and first post-Soviet generation.
But the thing is, they've created a whole generation through media, a whole generation which thinks like this as well. I mean, the conspiracy theories didn't start on Russian TV last year. They started around 2008.
2004 with the Orange Revolution was when it really, the fear of Orange kind of came in.
And not just about Americans. They use kind of like conspiracies about everything, about sort of pseudoscientific threats, about killer mold coming to get Russians. It's this whole kind of very, very sick psychology. And it's almost like there's a battle between that, which I think is, at the end of the day, utterly self-destructive, and just people who want a rational state and want to have rational lives. And increasingly, that's the tension. It's not between sort of nationalism and globalism, between West and East. I think these are just sort of the surface language. There's a much sicker thing going on at the heart of Russian society. So I see that tension playing out even more. I mean, it's a big thing when someone like Gurev leaves, when Kudrin leaves, people who basically think rationally. Mm-hmm. They've been forced out, and that kind of rational discourse has disappeared.
Gurev out of the country, Kudrin out of the structures of power.
These guys made sense. They're conformists. They're part of the system, but they're rational. Mm-hmm. And now we see sort of bizarre psychology, which at first I think we all thought was just play-acting, and now we're like, no, they've been play-acting a little bit too long for this to be just a game that they're playing.
So they believe their own hype. They've drank their own Kool-Aid, so to speak.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Ben, would you agree with that? Is that the fundamental the battle between sanity and insanity?
I think a useful paradigm for us to use in this conversation is when a country enters into a conflict with the West, suffers painful but not destructive economic sanctions, what's the spectrum? And the spectrum is, on one end, Iran, which endured no meaningful growth. It essentially lost its chance to be an emerging market like Turkey, like any of the rising Asian nations, and has endured painful American sanctions, little contact for decades. The other end of the spectrum is Serbia, in which after painful economic sanctions were placed on Serbia in the run-up and then after the NATO bombing campaign, it was widely believed by analysts that Serbia had entered this dangerous or Middle Eastern nightmare state where it would be unable to escape from because of the decade of propaganda under Milosevic, because of the decade of far more wild and crazy stuff on Serbian TV than we've seen yet, and far more blood, and far more violence, and far more mobilization. And Milosevic's regime collapsed pretty quickly after tough sanctions were placed on in the year 2000. So where does Russia sit on that spectrum?
Very good question. Where do you think it sits on that spectrum? Because that is a very good question.
I think the answer to that question is, how far can Russia's elites and middle classes and its poor cope with the new normal? And I think a way for us to sort of understand that would be trying to work out what the new normal is. Mm-hmm. So in kind of talking to bankers and important people in the financial world in Moscow, I think we can sketch out a couple of principles of what the next 10 years might look like. I mean, the first point to say is that the next 10 years are going to see minimum double the inflation rate of the previous 10 years. That we're looking at a standard inflation band of between 10 to 15% a year, possibly much more than that. So that's a real loss of people's real incomes. That's a diminution of 10 to 15% of what people can actually buy, what people can actually afford. We're going to see a much weaker ruble. We're going to see people being able to go on holiday less, buy less. That's an important factor. And in a sense, we've lost already because of the credit crunch, because of the gigantic capital flight, because of fear of investment, because of foreign investors pulling out. We've lost a decade of growth, which is Russia should be growing like China. Russia should be growing like India. Russia should be experiencing right now minimum 7% growth rates. What the Putin regime in the next decade ahead is going to be completely different from the Putin regime from 2000 to 2008, which was based on 8 to 10% growth. So a Putinism of 0% growth and fluctuating recession, that's going to be a very, very different place. I was just thinking the other day that we always like to draw the distinction with the way we deal with Russia today compared to the way we deal in the West, say other countries, is that we have this giant transnational floating oligarch capital between Russia and London, Russia and Switzerland, Russia and France. I think the interesting thing, actually, kind of historically, is how that's not been as important as we would have expected. It's not had an impact on Russia's development in proportion to its size. So that might hint that we're a little further away from the Serbia point than we might expect. I think a lot of this is kind of personality driven, in which is that Milosevic lost power because he lost his grip, he lost his nerve.
And the elite lost faith in him. The elite gave him up at the end of the day.
But he wasn't able to sustain being the great, clever, manipulative dictator. A dictator is only as good as his last rearrangement of the elite, as his last terrorizing of a big businessman. He just lost his touch. Whereas in Iran, you had one after another extremely highly talented, devoted, dedicated people trying to maintain that system that didn't allow any space for questioning. I think Putin, you know, he's of course obsessed about ice sports. He is a little bit like a figure skater in which all it takes is one slip and he's on the floor. How's the population going to deal with this? I think it's worth noting that in 2007, 2008, 2009, definitely the poor in Russia and the lower middle class thought their country was at war. They were very, very shocked by it. They were worried about it. They were delighted that Russia had triumphed. There was mobilization. And that very, very quickly fell away, and it very, very quickly can move into fear. One of those people's main concerns, what Russians in industrial towns and Russians in kind of the poorer parts of Moscow, their opinions are driven, you know, about, it's very much about economics, it's about their quality of life. And I don't think that all of them are going to be, or even now, completely in love with this idea of kind of Novorossiya and imperialism. There's what's interesting in these kind of opinion polls from Russia is that on the flip side of these high popularity ratings for Putin is that you consistently had opinion polls showing that almost as many people, if not more people, say that the Russian government is corrupt, the Russian government doesn't provide services, they don't see a future for their children, they're horrified by high levels of immigration, they're frightened to walk on the streets, they think ethnic tensions are very likely. It makes you wonder what that 80% or that 40% actually says. And I'm very distrustful of these opinion poll figures in general because of the way they're collected. They're collected by telephone. People at home, so who's at home with a landline, are phoned up and asked, do you support President Putin? Well, somebody phoned me up and asked me if I supported President Putin, and I was a kind of old grandmother living in Ulyanovsk or Kaliningrad. I would say yes. I don't know who this person is. That's the kind of response you get. And what's that yes mean? That yes means I support the continued presence of Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin. Well, I'm not sure even Russia's most diehard anti-Putin critic wants him to leave right now. And I think this support, it's very easy for analysts to go, Putin's got a giant popularity rating. And this is a mistake because opinion polls, an opinion poll in Britain of whether or not we support the fake right-wing party or the fake left-wing party, that we know what both of them have to say. We know what's for sale. Right. We know their opinions more or less. And so people can make up their own minds. When people don't know what the alternative is, you can't have a proper functioning opinion.
No, this is a point we've made in this podcast in the past, too, that these opinion polls are, we can't compare them to Western opinion polls because you don't have anything to compare Putin to. And that in order to rule the way he wants to rule, he's got to keep his numbers up in the, you know, above 60, 70%.
Just one last point about kind of how far can we go. I agree with Peter. I think that's definitely what they will do. They don't really have much of a choice to pursue this sort of mobilization narrative. I think it's, and definitely at least for the next year or two, it might be possible for them, thanks to flip it around and go for and play Putin the peacemaker, Putin who reconciled with the West. I don't think they can do that for at least the next 18 months, just until people sort of forget about it at home. There've been a few change of leaders, and that might be linked to the US election. That might be linked to even Putin's own election of wanting to kind of release the doves on Red Square and the new era of peace dawning. I was worried just structurally that this had been a very cheap war, that they had annexed Crimea at basically no cost, and they had fought this dirty war with only sort of 60 to 100 odd people being slapped on a kind of vague, easy to manipulate EU sanctions list. And I thought they would then think in the future, the next 10 years, that these sort of hits of nationalist cocaine are not very expensive. Mm. Well, thanks to the EU banking sanctions, it has been very expensive. And a lot of people have lost a lot of money out of this. Like, this Novorossiya project has personally cost oligarchs, in terms of their valuations, hundreds of millions. It's cost Russian state banks vast amounts. It's cost Putin a lot more than one or two of his right-hand men losing the chance to visit villas in Italy. And I think they will, in the future, avoid hits of cocaine that are that expensive. They'll go for the cheaper, more synthetic stuff.
Peter, let's bring you into the conversation here. For, I mean, Ben's given us a whole lot to chew on here. First, I really like this spectrum of Iran to Serbia, because I think that really does put it in, gives us a good paradigm to work with. First, where do you see Russia along that spectrum there? Closer to Iran or closer to Serbia?
Russia is its own beast, but I mean, closer to Iran because it has some sort
So it can endure this for a while. It'll cost it, but it can endure it.
Well, and also the sort of the hydrocarbons factor, you know, there's more maybe Iran things there. Also, it's a separate civilized, you know, it's always seen itself as a separate empire, an entity. I mean, what is Serbia? It's like, you know, can barely, I mean, as in like, it had to fight just to be a nation, let alone try to be an empire. the sense of self is bigger. But I really worry more than that about Russia. I really do worry that we're talking about something quite self-destructive. I mean, for the Iranians, didn't the Iranians kind of have to do what they did in order to sort of survive, sort of create their theocracy? I mean, I'm not the biggest expert, but Russia is just so incredibly unnecessary that I do feel that the rot is much deeper and more self-destructive. I'm trying to think of an example of a country that kind of ate itself up from within and started making incredibly stupid decisions based on that. I don't think they're doing survival. They're not doing survival. They're doing something much weirder and more pathological than that. Somebody compared it recently to me, like somebody who's got AIDS and is trying to infect other people with it. It's the sickness is much worse than just kind of like, you know, isolationism and survival. I'm trying to think of an example. What other countries have done that?
Well, I mean, there was an interesting thing. I read an interesting comment by Gleb Pavlovsky recently. So he was asked if he thought the Putin regime would fall. And he said, when this regime falls, it will fall in one day and be replaced by something exactly like it. would you agree with that?
No, not in terms of its pathology. No, I mean, what you mean, another type of soft authoritarianism or hybrid? Maybe
that's I think what he meant. Yeah,
sure. I mean, they're very popular nationally. But it's not being the last 10 years or the last 12 years. The Putin regime was playing a game. It was playing it very, very, you know, I think we have to admit, fairly well. It's not playing a game anymore. It's just doing sort of self-destructive stuff. That's what everyone's reaction is like. What are you doing? Why? And increasingly, I'm starting to hear this from inside of Russia. This is why I think the Great Division is now going to be sort of rational decision-making and irrational. Putin is basically trying to make irrational decision-making the new normal. Like, let's ban foodstuffs. What? You know, let's ban baby foods. Why? But there's a deep logic to that within Russian society. There is a big sort of self-destructive strain there, which makes irrational decisions. So I think that's kind of the tension. The model that it could choose once it starts behaving rationally could well be very could well continue to be partly isolationist, but it wouldn't be so bizarre.
So I guess if we have to wrap up the first section, I mean, the new normal is going to be a lot more of this craziness. I mean, is that what we?
Well, a new normal would mean that they can start making rational decisions and restabilize, find a new stability. My fear is, and that's what I thought was going on, but increasingly my fear is that they don't have a plan for a new normal or a new stability. We're talking about spiraling. They're just spiraling into delirium, which is far more frightening than a new authoritarian model or a stronger authoritarian model. I don't know. I'm talking more on instincts. Just they keep on, I mean, as some people have been saying, I mean, they keep on getting off of these kind of like, off-road and compromises. And you just keep on missing them.
Right. Ben, any last thoughts before we move on to the next section where we'll talk about dissent a little bit?
What I noticed in speaking to British officials and important people in the London financial world is that over the last 2 or 3 weeks, there's been a shudder that maybe they do believe their own propaganda. Maybe they do genuinely think that the danger of Ukraine moving into the EU or NATO is worthy of war. And there's a sense that amongst those people that perhaps we were a little bit mistaken to think that because they turned up at Davos and they were very friendly and they also went skiing in Courchevel and a couple of people had dinner with them in the Hurlingham Club in London, that maybe they weren't so similar after all. That's a kind of sort of feeling and a little confession I've got from one or two officials and bankers, that maybe it was a mistake to think that it was all propaganda and it was all about feeding the people with manipulative things that would allow them to get on with their own corruption.
Well, this would dovetail with, Peter, you brought this up last week, that this system is beginning to collapse in on itself, where people don't even know what's true and what's not anymore, because this and that's where the real danger of this collapsing into itself comes. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion about Russia's emerging new normal and look at the reemergence of dissent, from urban thrill seekers to rap and rock stars. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Peter Pomerantsev, author of the forthcoming book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, The Surreal Heart of the New Russia. And also joining us from London, also via Skype, is Ben Judah, author of the book Fragile Empire, How Russians Fell Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Фотография желто-голубой звезды над одной из семи сталинских
высоток. Такое колористическое решение москвичей, ехавших сегодня на работу мимо высотки.
Золотую звезду и установили украинский флаг.
Наше сегодняшнее выступление мы хотели бы посвятить всем жертвам информационной войны.
Андрей Макаревич на этой неделе совершил турне по городам
Украины. Депутаты Госдумы раскритиковали поведение Андрея Макаревича.
Губерната от Бога, который сегодня с нами.
Urban daredevils hoist a blue and yellow Ukrainian flag atop one of Moscow's iconic Stalin-era skyscrapers, one that I once lived in, by the way. The rap artist Noise MC, whose ambient sounds grace this podcast, takes a Ukrainian flag on stage during a concert in Lviv. And Andrei Makarevich, frontman for the band Mashina Vremeni, plays a concert for IDP children in Ukraine and sparks a backlash in the State Duma. And Russian oppositionists have taken to singing the Ukrainian national anthem while being detained by police. After a period of hibernation, dissent appears to be making a comeback in Russia, and it has a blue and yellow tint. Ben, what do you think? Insignificant whispers in the darkness, or can this whisper turn into a roar?
I think that the previous nodes of dissent in Russia really are very battered. Is that the movement around Navalny has suffered very serious loss of personnel, steam, funding. I think that the journalist activist website model of dissent is still very much reeling. These people, lots of them have moved to London recently. They're very pessimistic. Lots of those journalists, lots of that generation have left journalism. Lots of those activists have pulled back. The real boost to that movement, which was creating an alliance between nationalists and liberals, at least for the protest park, was really smashed by Putin when the Russian hipster nationalist, online nationalist, fringe nationalists excitedly and enthusiastically backed the Novorossiya campaign. I think emblematic of that was the glorious Sputnik and Pogrom, very influential blog, backed Putin, Novorossiya, and stopped making cool graphic designs of Putin looking like a monster to cool graphic designs of Putin as a liberator of the ethnic heartlands of Russia on the Black Sea and in Donbass. So the old sadly, what we can already call the old opposition, I don't think they're very enthusiastic about dissent right now. There's a very high level of paranoia amongst those people. There have been a lot of rumours circulating recently, one about exit visas, which appears not to be linked to reality, one about a new wave of arrests that is linked to nothing more than a gut instinct. Speaking to very important people in that movement, one of whom just fled Moscow to London, there's been some quite excited talk that even though things are going to get much darker and much more difficult in the next 2 years, there will be a crash of the Putin regime linked to Ukraine. But the same person was very willing to say that for the Russian opposition right now, you've got to hope that it gets a lot better in order for it to get a lot better. And there are a few of them who are almost hoping that Putin will fully invade Ukraine.
And yet people are willing to paint the spire and star atop the Vysotka and Katalinskaya Navrozhnaya yellow and blue, and yet rock musicians let's face it, Makarevich wasn't exactly an opposition figure, are willing to make these acts. People like Noise MC are taking a flag on stage and not backing down from it in the aftermath after they're criticized. So the old nodes.
I mean, we shouldn't confuse two different kinds of dissent. I think there is liberal and nationalist dissent trying to roll back the Putin regime's authoritarianism, which is opposed fundamentally to the Putin system, which is opposed to corruption, is opposed to oligarchs, is opposed to the secret police. And then there is people who are maybe sort of against that, but people who are disgusted about the clash between the brother nations, Russia and Ukraine. I think that's a very different kind of dissent. I've seen circulating quite a lot on the internet a quote from Solzhenitsyn, who, of course, favoured the incorporation of Ukraine into Russia, saying that if ever there was a war between Ukraine and Russia, he would tell his son not to fight in it, and he wouldn't fight in it. I think as the threat of an actual all-out war between Russia and Ukraine becomes real, there's a different kind of dissent, which is how can we possibly be going beyond the edge of war with a kind of brother and fraternal nation? It's not the Democrats, it's not the punks, it's not the Pussy Rioters, it's different.
No, I think you're onto something there. And if you look at Noise MC's comments on Kontaktia, talking about why he did take that flag on the stage, he said, Russians and Ukrainians are brothers. We shouldn't fear or hate each other, and we certainly shouldn't fight each other. I'm paraphrasing him, of course, but that was the gist of what he said.
Yeah, but that's a feeling that cuts through. I think for Western listeners, for British listeners especially, it's very quite difficult to understand the relationship with Russia and Ukraine, but it shouldn't be. Because Russia and Ukraine are very kind of married into one another. The ethnic lines are very blurred. Vast amounts of people in the Kremlin and the Russian elite have Ukrainian roots and vice versa. And the comparison is actually England and Scotland, where we have maybe no one's ever counted, maybe 20 to 30% of people in the British government who are of Scottish heritage. You have a vast amount of people, again, no one's really ever counted, who are of mixed English and Scottish ancestry. And the prospect of England and Scotland going to war is just horrifying and shocking. And for people of that heritage, invokes the idea of them having to kind of choose or go to war against part of themselves. To give another British metaphor, these kind of family blood feuds are often the most vicious. For example, Britain and Ireland, incredibly married into one another. I saw a statistic that a quarter of British people have one Irish grandparent or great-grandparent. And the proximity of that didn't stop there being a long blood feud after the disintegration of the British dominion over Ireland following the First World War. In fact, it gave a sense of revanche and bitterness to both sides.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what are your thoughts on this, on the dissent and on the issues of Russia and Ukraine that Ben has raised?
It'll be interesting how many people turn up for the Stop the War march.
Yes, it will. September 21st.
Yeah, I think there could actually be a very wide coalition of people who just don't want war. It's not about Putin or anything. They just really don't want war. I think that could actually be quite a lot of people and quite a horizontal phenomenon. But you know, look, firstly, there's always been courageous people in Russia, even the darkest days of the Soviet Union. So I think I'd be very alarmed if there were no noise MCs. But, you know, there's always been people who stand up for kind of dignity in themselves. I think Ben's actually made the most powerful point. After the 2012 protests, it would not have been difficult for Putin to manipulate that crowd of people by bringing them in, spinning them, you know, the usual kind of thing that they do. It was not such a huge movement. It wasn't a movement with teeth. It would have been so easy to spin these guys.
And this is what Surkov wanted him to do, apparently.
It made complete sense. This was not a threat. Instead, they did this idiotic thing of painting themselves in an ideological corner. I mean, Putin's now trying to become more middle, but he's like, you know, he's completely painted himself in, which is, for a soft authoritarian, that's a very, very bad thing. Because being a soft authoritarian is based on being able to change roles. So as Ben says, he can't just be the peacekeeper now. You know, if he'd give himself more options, he could be war man, peacekeeper next day. Now he's become much harder, and that's much less. It's harder for him to move, and even more so. He's done at the end of the day the protest movement a massive favor because yes, he's sending the country spiraling into economic disaster, and so the movement against him won't be kind of a anti-Putin movement or anti-Russia movement. It'll just be like we need bread movement, which is going to be far more powerful. I think he's done a bigger favor in the kind of medium run to any protest movement that they could have done. He could have won this and kept the economy bubbling along. Instead, he's pretty much done everything wrong.
Ben brought up Navalny, and you know, God, go back a year and he was all we were talking about, and now he's disappeared. Has Navalny been completely defanged? Because his behavior throughout this whole thing has been he's been under house arrest, but he's been consistently against the Russian actions in Ukraine, losing a lot of his national support along the way. But is Navalny defanged entirely? Is he no longer a factor?
Well, Navalny's lost. Navalny expanded quite rapidly in terms of how many people working for him. I think it went from about 10 to about 30 from December 2011 to 2012, and even more around him. Following his kind of peak, which seems to have been
Moscow elections, yeah.
10 to 20,000 people. I think his peak was really the 10 to 20,000 people running out in an illegal protest.
Well, yeah.
To call his name, his call for him to be released, which frightened the Kremlin. He's suffered a very big loss of cadre, a very big loss of team around him. His press secretary going off to the US to do an MA. His right-hand man, Mr. Vladimir Ashurkov, has just moved to London and had to flee. That was a really key organizer, if not the key organizer, in his team. His investigators in London and Moscow have got very low morale, and they've just censured the authorities with these endless trials opening up increasingly against his family, have really put him under the equivalent of a DDoS attack, which they haven't broken the computer. They've just meant he can do nothing apart from attempt to debug it, and he's sort of quite paralyzed by that. I think Putin put him in a really difficult position, which is because Navalny does sincerely, deeply believe Russia and Ukraine are one nation, should be one state. He wants this. He sees this. That's his heritage and it's his vision. He just thinks that Putin has gone about the way most likely to guarantee that never happens. He appears to have lost his moment in a way.
And it's amazing how fast it happened, because you say, yeah, probably July of last year was when all those people took to the streets. And that momentum continued. Of course, his triumphant return to Moscow by train, the speech at the Vauxhall. And then the Moscow mayor's election when he exceeded all expectations, and then poof. He was gone. Peter, what do you think?
Look, he's under house arrest. He can't really move around. And as you say, his kind of like what Putin has been very good at doing is breaking that kind of link between the nationalists and the liberals. But, you know, something tells me we haven't seen the last of him. It might be a new kind of coalition that he leads. But seriously, I mean, The Coalition for Sanity is going to be bigger than the Coalition of Hipsters and Nationalist Nutcases. The Coalition is going to be bigger. And if the economy gets worse, people can just see that life is getting worse, then I think that'll be quite a strong movement.
The Coalition for Sanity. I think I like that. Any last thoughts before we wrap up for this week?
I think Peter's made a very, very powerful point, which is that what Putin needs to be wary of isn't a revival of the old coalition of Bolotnaya, but is this potentially far bigger, far broader coalition for French cheese and against the killing of one's Ukrainian cousins that could emerge if he goes just slightly too far in either the retaliatory sanctions against the EU or the campaign in Ukraine. What is interesting for me is what could spark that. I think one very emblematic death in eastern Ukraine could spark that. One family, one story which really gets out and goes viral, something that makes it all seem terribly real. I think this information about body bags coming in secret, people posting online that they saw Russian troops being buried in, I think it was Pskov, that's starting to trickle into the national consciousness. And one, if that can come out, and there's no reason to believe that it won't come out, if this continues and gets much worse, that could really sort of, that horror can be brought, would be brought home.
So it's a coalition for sanity, French cheese, and against killing our Ukrainian cousins. That does sound like a broad coalition, indeed. Peter, final thoughts before we close it out for the week.
You know, up till now, for so long, I've always kind of like, I've been very much on the side that the Kremlin is actually just playing this clever, rational game. And I don't know what point, it was several weeks ago, actually. It was maybe a couple of weeks ago. It was in New York, and I received... They'd banned something ridiculous. And I was like, I'm not sure they're playing at madness anymore. I'm just not sure anymore. I'm suddenly like, you know, at one point the mask can stick. You know what I mean? At the start, they were definitely using the fact that they might be rational as a threat. You know, this ridiculous, you know, when they said when this the senators passed this law about allowing Putin to invade Ukraine, purposefully using Soviet language to make us feel that the Soviet Union is back. I mean, that was pure intimidation. That was the use of hyperbole to intimidate everyone. Now, it just seems to be in a spiral of really bad decisions. And I think there's a rational explanation for it as well. One doesn't have to be sort of like literary about it. Look, they're making their decisions based on an information loop, which is based on pleasing their own paranoia. You know what I mean? You talk to people around the national security apparatus, and they're like, they're not making the information they're getting isn't rational information anymore. Mm. So they're actually literally caught in a loop, an information feedback loop of you know, utter shite. And I'm very worried now. I wasn't before. Now I'm increasingly worried that they're going to start doing things which are very, very self-destructive.
Well, we'll see as this develops in the coming weeks and months, and that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line has been Peter Pomerantsev, author of the forthcoming book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, The Surreal Heart of the New Russia, that'll be out in November. And also joining us from London and also via Skype has been Ben Judah, author of the book Fragile Empire, How Russians Fell Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening and lively discussion. And I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.